We've just heard an elegant discussion around diffusive solute clearance and the yin and the yang of clearance. Now will bring us to convective solute clearance, and our speaker is Dr. Henderson.
Thank you, Jonathan. Good morning, John. Good morning to all of you. It gets early, awfully early out at this hour each day, and I hope the subsequent discussion will not find most of you sound asleep. I'm instructed by friends who study teaching methodology that there's a window of opportunity to communicate with an audience in a long talk that exists for about 10 minutes. After that, 80% of the audience is engaged in sexual fantasy or other non-intellectual pursuits. So I'm going to get right into this. If I could have the first slide here. Wipe that out.
Is that a different computer? Or?
There we go. All right. I'm going to invert the usual sequence here and give you my summary and conclusions, hopefully taking advantage of that window of opportunity. I'll then go through and give examples of convective solute transport noted here. Jonathan, I give up. How do I turn the pointer on? Oh, here we go. Okay. Convective solute transport is something that, and again, I need to be able to see the slide to quote, there is deliberate convective solute transport in the form of hemodiafiltration or hemofiltration. There's inadvertent hemodiafiltration and this sort of Starling's flow effect that Bill Clark spoke to you about earlier. There'll be a certain amount of overlap between what Bill has said and what I will say, simply because convection and diffusion are interlinked and one cannot be discussed in isolation of with the other. So here's convective solute transport occurs when hypertonic peritoneal dialysate is used. Convective solute transport results in a broader spectrum of toxic solute removal. Convective solute transport alters the surrogate status that urea holds for other toxic solutes in uremia. Convective solute transport is sensitive to changes. Well, you can read this as fast as I can, but the diffusive mechanism is sensitive to a second order phenomenon of the pore, the radius, mean pore radius, whereas convective solute transport, it's the fourth power. Bill spoke about the second power relationship. I'll talk a little bit about the fourth power. Again, convective solute transport is insensitive to membrane thickness compared to diffusive solute transport, and it is not always correlated, not always, commonly it is, but not always correlated with high water flux rates. I'll show you an example of that. Convective solute transport is commonly determined by something called the sieving coefficient, which is a phenomenological process or identifier that it does involve process-related events, whereas another way of expressing convective solute transport is with Staverman sigma, a parameter that is a purely membrane-related phenomenon. And lastly, this convective solute transport, if you do not account for it, can make for an invisible clearance that you would measure if you were doing conventional measurements of clearance for a high flux dialyzer. All right, so just looking at curves, this is a curve for convection, whereas this would be more the shape of the curve for hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis down here. This is whole blood clearance and increasing molecular weight. This is just to give you a feeling for the shapes of the curves. This is analogous to the human kidney, as we'll see later. Again, in the definitions department, diffusion, as you've heard from Bill, is simply Brownian motion. It is inherently size discriminatory. Convection, on the other hand, is an interaction between frictional forces in the fluid and against the molecule, and this carrying out of solute with solvent, and is size discriminatory only at the pore size cutoff. So you have a much broader spectrum of solute removal with convective clearance than you do with diffusive clearance. These are, again, nomenclature. High efficiency hemodialysis, I think you're familiar with. I'll let you buzz that definition, but transport is dominated by diffusion, whereas hemodiafiltration, transport by diffusion is not the key issue here. It is more convective. Convection dominates it. This is an interesting comparison by Bill Dean at MIT. This is the Divine prototype native kidneys. This is a hollow fiber dialyzer. The points of note, I think, relate to the differences in hydraulic permeability. We think we're dealing with high permeability, hydraulic permeability membranes. When you look at a glomerular basement membrane, you realize that we're pretty low on the scale. These are definitions of dialyzer water permeability or flux. This is the FDA definition relating to 8 millimeters or 8 ml per millimeter of mercury as contrasted with the high permeability value greater than 8. And the HEMO study used a different set of definitions. So it's well to know what your definitions are when you're speaking about high flux dialyzers. This is an equation that you've seen from Bill Clark. This is the diffusive mass transfer in hemodialysis. I call your attention to the fact that within this case of Nod and the NTAC, as he has described, there's a second order dependence on the mean pore radius. This is to be contrasted with the fourth power dependence on water permeability now, the fourth power of this mean pore radius. This is a set of membranes that you are likely familiar with, showing estimated mean pore radius and the correlating ultrafiltration rates, and it correlates quite nicely with the theoretical formulation that you've just seen.
What about solute transport, and how does that relate? Well, sieving coefficients, you've heard Bill Clark speak about sieving coefficients. This is commonly defined as the concentration in the ultrafiltrate over the average of the inflow and outflow plasma concentrations. For solutes such as urea, there are no difference in any of these three values, and the sieving coefficient is unity. There is this fourth order dependence on flow rate, which makes this an important adjuster of transport. Consider now an unusual circumstance. This is where a membrane hydraulic permeability does not correlate with hydraulic permeability. I'm giving you a circumstance in which you have a high density of pores with small mean pore radius, as contrasted with a small density of pores with a large mean pore radius. And here you can see the results showing a membrane with high hydraulic permeability, but really quite a tight sieving coefficient. There are such membranes on the market now, the polysulfone membrane from Asahi exhibits this characteristic. The sieving coefficient, as I've said, is a phenomenologic parameter. It is related to certain constants, Staverman sigma, for example, this reflection coefficient, the permeability of the membrane, but there are and the area of the membrane, but there are variables in this calculation of S. The variable of flow rate over area and flow rate in particular is important. This has to be quantified. One generally, when one measures a sieving coefficient in clinical operation, and one needs to know the relationship between the JV or the filtration rate that you're operating at in order to come at what the actual sieving coefficient is going to be. You will note that for a high JV, such as an HDF or HF, you see sieving coefficient approaching 1 minus Staverman sigma. Staverman sigma being this intrinsic membrane parameter, S being the phenomenological parameter. So for pure convection, S approaches 1 minus sigma. For low flux rate membranes, such as conventional dialysis or low flux membranes operated in HDF, you can see a significant flow-related component come in, and S no longer is equal simply to 1 minus the reflection coefficient. This is sort of contrasting the two. This is an uppercase sigma. It should be a lowercase sigma. That's the conventional way to express it. But this is an intrinsic membrane property that's independent of operating conditions, and it's a calculated term. Sieving coefficient, on the other hand, can be related to rejection coefficient as 1 minus the rejection, and rejection is approximately equal to sigma. It is a phenomenologic parameter. It is dependent on the operating conditions under which it is measured. It is similar to Jaffrin's transmittance, for those of you who are into that sort of thing. And as I say, it is measured, not calculated. This Peclet number is the engineer's description of this interaction between filtration rate and membrane permeability. And you can see the respective Peclet numbers for a small solute and a large solute for three forms of therapy. And you can see for hemofiltration, a high flux rate, the Peclet number is very high. For CAPD, it's higher than hemo, and for low flux hemo, it's quite low. So one does not have to pay attention to Peclet for a routine hemodialysis. This just is an example on the bench of, this is a native kidney clearance just in a dog, just to show you what the sieving profile is for polydispersed neutral dextran. And here you see an increasing velocity of flow across the membrane, and you see sieving coefficients curves falling in an orderly manner throughout this increase in flow. So that is the impact of flow. There is an interaction between sieving coefficient and flow across the membrane. Bill spoke about back filtration. I think of it as a Starling's flow for the artificial kidney, where Starling had identified that there's a driving pressure on the arteriolar end of the capillary where filtration occurs, and then a back filtration when pressure gradients are reduced at the venular end. In any dialyzer that has high flux, if you enclose the dialysate path, you'll see this Starling's flow, and then take the next step and circulate dialysate and countercurrent flow in this manner, and you'll see what Bill described of high concentrations of solute being convected across the membrane and then being swept to drain as fresh dialysate enters, so that the backflow that you see here is largely of clean dialysate, not containing the convected out larger molecular weight solutes. So that this sort of thing is an inadvertent, if you will, clearance hemodiafiltration. Inadvertent hemodiafiltration, it occurs when you're using high flux membranes with fluid balancing equipment. And it makes it very difficult to get a clear quantification of clearance and calculation of KOA becomes useless. This is a conceptual diagram of a pore distribution of pores in a, for this example, peritoneal membrane. Here we see glucose being used as an osmotic agent. It acts only on the small pores. The small pores, because in order to act, it has to be resisted in transport back across the pore. For a large pore such as this, glucose simply diffuses through that pore, and it is not used to bring fluid out or convect solutes across. On the other hand, if one turned around now, as we did in a rather complex experiment, and put hydrostatic pressure across the peritoneal membrane, you see engagement of a larger subset of pores, and the presence of convection in that setting will give even a broader spectrum of solutes that are removed as contrasted with glucose. Ray Credit in the Netherlands has done this experiment using inulin in patients. We did this in rabbits using hydrostatic rather than osmotic pressure. Ray Credit used a large polymer down here to draw the water across. But in engaging the larger pores, showed that in point of fact, inulin moved across the peritoneal membrane with greater ease than when simply glucose was used and the small pore population was engaged. The interaction between protein and the membrane is an important one to bear in mind. Virtually every membrane, and here are three examples, show a reduction not only in hydraulic permeability, but in sieving coefficient when protein solution is used as contrasted with saline solution. Here you can see the Ringer saline, and yet when protein is used, plasma, there's a shift in these curves to the left and a reduction in sieving coefficient. The influence of protein on the membrane, it can change the mean pore radius simply by fouling the larger pores. That is, it can adsorb to the pore interstices and make for smaller pores or fouling of pores, or simply fouling of the larger pores so that a pore distribution is shifted to a smaller subset. It can also develop a discriminating secondary membrane on the surface of your filtration membrane. The protein is brought to that surface, it can't cross. The flow of fluids toward the membrane simply causes a buildup of protein at the surface. Or both of these things can occur. But in general, hydraulic permeability and sieving coefficients fall in the face of protein's presence in the filtered solution. This is simply showing percent change in sieving coefficient for a variety of membranes in saline to blood. So when you're hearing membrane performance described, it's well to know what the conditions are and what solutions are being used. The consequences of convective transport on hemodialysis clearance I've mentioned before, but I'll mention them again. It alters the surrogate status of urea for the spectrum of solutes that are removed, so that urea, which is frequently used as an index of adequacy, suddenly has a changed status in terms of its ability to predict outcome. Underestimates it underestimates the clearance of small solutes unless you take into account the ultrafiltration. This is the invisible clearance that I spoke about before. It increases oncotic force of plasma protein, and this can, as Bill has said to you earlier, alter transport across red cells by causing actual shrinking of red cells and movement of water out of the red cell. The surrogate status for urea on more toxic solutes changes when convective transport is there, when time and frequency of treatment is changed. And we're going to see a lot of this because of home treatments, the Tassin experience of 8 hours three times a week, the daily 8 hour a week therapies, the 2 hour daily therapies. These we're going to see a lot of interplay here. I would point out that for those therapies, KT over V has not been qualified as clinically relevant to predict outcome. Those clinical studies have not been done. KT over V has been looked at by the Tassin group and found not to correlate with outcome. Flow rates of blood and dialysate, if they are changed, as Bill has suggested, you see an alteration in the surrogate status for urea. I put this cautionary hieroglyph at the bottom. I think you need to know what the operating conditions are for the KT over V that's being measured, and then you have to ask, have those operating conditions been clinically qualified to correlate with outcome? Because if they have not, you do not have a good handle on the adequacy of the treatment of your patients. This just shows that most mammalian glomeruli behave in the same way with respect to neutral dextran and its fractional clearance. Fractional clearance can also be considered as a similar to sieving coefficient. But these are dog data that Ken Leipold and myself developed. These are from other authors, but they're really quite similar. This point is I wish to make here is relating to the difference that we see in the rabbit glomerulus. Now, this is an in vivo study when neutral dextran is used as contrasted with dextran that is positively and negatively charged. It's interesting that the clinical literature identifies that negative charge is restrained by the glomerular basement membrane, that is negatively charged proteins. But for the rabbit, which certainly is analogous to the human, it doesn't matter what the charge is. Irrespective of the sign of the charge, the solute is less well, it traverses the membrane less well. Now, how does this apply to the hemodialysis or hemofiltration setting? Well, here are the same set of dextrans, neutral, positive and negatively charged, with a polysulfone membrane that carries no intrinsic membrane charge. Here we see it for a polyacrylonitrile membrane that carries a net negative surface charge. And once again, it behaves like the rabbit glomerulus and likely the human glomerulus by showing that irrespective of sign of charge, charge on the solute considered makes it harder to cross the membrane if the membrane carries a charge. I would like to wrap up with a discussion of the convective solute transport. These are the summary and conclusions that I gave you before. For those who would care to review them again, I will not read them, but I will let you read in silence. Thank you. I'll take questions at this point.
We have time for questions. Thank you, Lee. Is this microphone working? I had a question regarding the question of back filtration. Is it possible, since this is also a silent process, filtration, back filtration, you may not be able to get a handle on it with conventional clearance measurements. Is it possible to look at countercurrent flow and co-current flow, comparing differences in clearances to get a handle on how much back filtration might be occurring, since it's much more of a phenomenon in the co-current direction?
That's a very interesting thought, Tom. I've not done that. And I'd engage Bill's thinking and Brother Ward's thinking on this subject as well, because I think that there's been no effort really to, the only paper I know that attempts to quantify this is an ancient work in the Journal of Blood Purification by Schmidt. And he, using inulin as I recollect this, argued that about 20% of the inulin cleared was by this intrinsic convection back diffusion method. But I'm not sure how rigorous that work was. It's a good question. Yes, sir.
Those studies you mentioned didn't include reuse. I was wondering what happens to these convective forces when you reuse or
That's a very good question. It's interesting that if you expose a hemofiltration membrane to protein and then deliberately go back and try and rinse back flushing and through the lumen of the fiber to clear that, you cannot. The sieving properties stay low even though you go back to saline after the membrane has been exposed to protein. So reuse is going to, unless you employ an agent that denatures protein and really pulls it off the membrane, is not going to give you back your original properties. And may I say, this happens very quickly. This is a matter of in the first 3 or 4 minutes of exposure to plasma. So I'm not sure that the reuse is going to be a problem for you, if you take my drift.
I have a question. Let's just say that us in the audience have heard the HEMO study results, haven't seen it published yet, and say, well, we want to know what the next step we can take to improve outcomes of our patients would be. And I've heard from both you and Bill that perhaps if we were to look in the middle molecule direction, that convective clearance might be the way to improve that. Whether it has an effect on outcome, I don't know. Given what you just said, how would one do that? Would one tell their patients, drink as much as you can because we're going to remove it? In anecdotally, you know, Richard Sherman has shown patients who drink the most live the longest. I don't know what they were drinking. Or would it be important the membrane that we use? I mean, given this discussion on middle molecule clearance and phosphorus removal, which direction do you think we should go? I mean, force a lot of ultrafiltration or use a membrane?
I'd like to go both directions, John. I think that there is room for improvement in the membranes that we now use for hemodiafiltration. I'd like to see us move toward more convective transport, not less. I don't want to throw away diffusion. That's a valuable tool. We should be using everything we can lay our hands on. So I would maximize my membrane's thinness, as Bill talked about. I would open the pore structure of that membrane so that it has the hydraulic permeability, if you will, of the human glomerulus. I would then have the patient's convect as much, whether this is drinking more and dialyzing every day or hemodiafiltering every day for a couple of hours, so that convective loss is augmenting the diffusive loss. I'd like to do all of those things. Ideally, I'd like to have a human kidney, but that... Yes, sir.
Question, like how many liters do you think you should be removing to have a clinically significant effect for a patient?
That hasn't been quantitated. It should be. In in pre-dilution mode, which I've had early direct experience with, we used to turn over 100 liters into the plasma and back out again over a 5-hour time frame. Hemodiafiltration in the 18 to 20 liter time frame would be, well, this has been looked at by Quellhorst in post-dilution mode, hemodiafiltration less. There needs to be an orderly quantitation. I'd love to know what spectrum of solutes is required to be cleared, and then we can come at that question more quantitatively.
So are we going to see the results of and the benefit from the hemodiafiltrations later, or?
I think I think you will see, I'm citing now inferential work by Leipold using retrospective data from USRDS, correlating B12 clearance with outcome and showing a significant correlation there. I think there needs to be a study population like the HEMO study, but with greater separation in the parameters followed. Our variation, or the variation as I'm led to believe, I've not seen published results of that study, I think none of us have, but they're relatively slight contrasted with the difference, for example, between what native kidney provides or even what 8 hours three times a week provides.
One more question.
Yeah.
On one of your slides, you showed that with increased flow, there is a decrease in the sieving coefficient. Does that mean you're talking about the flow through the fiber or through the membrane?
That's through the membrane. Okay. That's filtration rate through the membrane.
Does increase if you take the clearance versus the sieving coefficient? Do you have an increase in clearance?
That is a complex function, and your point is well taken. You'd like to have a sieving coefficient of unity so that the clearance, if you will, by filtration is equivalent to the filtration rate, sieving coefficient, translating it to one. As you are using protein and as you get very high in filtration rate, you lose that, it drops down. There needs to be optimization of that relationship between flow rate and sieving coefficient.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.